Hi, Mark.
Hi, Jeffrey.
Gee.
Am I? Wait a second. All right.
Yeah, there we go. Keeps the ambient noise down a bit.
Yeah, works better. So I don't figure I got 20 years left.
Yeah, well, you have to start young.
I know, it's kind of.
But maybe I don't have 20 years left. I don't know, but.
It's too late for me.
Although I think you can, I don't think you, I don't think you can count on not having 20 years left, right?
My father lived to be 96.
There you go.
But big but. My two uncles, his two brothers, they both died about at 70 with heart failure. And my father had a heart attack at 69. So that's pretty, you know, runs in the family, so to speak.
But the idea is not so much the 20 years as such. It's more a big lever on big goals, right? So
yeah, I think you're right, and that's. I was talking to my psych girl last session, sort of about that, and yeah, I've pretty much lived my life the opposite. I do things, but I've never had like a extended life plan, which
is fine. I mean, I'm not saying that everybody should do this. I'm just saying that it worked for me.
Well, I think it's a good idea, generally speaking, you know. I think it would eliminate a lot of anxiety for people.
I don't know that it does that, because you can't. Because I mean, ideally one would like to have a 20-year plan for, you know, a lot of different things, but in practice you cannot do that. You have to pick one thing and then orient yourself towards that one thing, which means you have to give other things up. And so you don't lose uncertainty or anxiety as a result. In some ways you gain some on the other end, as it were, you know.
Well, yeah, I think it's a cost bet, you know, you're doing a cost benefit
exactly
analysis, you know, you're getting whatever you do has costs.
Exactly.
And oftentimes you have to give up something to gain something.
Right.
But I never thought about any of that.
But it's just that, you know, a lot of people say, well, you know, I'm just one person. What can I do? And in a way, this is an argument. Well, one person can do a lot if you set your mind to it, you know, so.
Yeah. But that, yes, that takes some guidance from somebody, you know, an adult somewhere to, you know, your parents, a teacher, something to put you on that track.
Not sure exactly what guidance I had, but anyway.
it's
a good question.
It's going to be fascinating why you wound up. I think it's a fascinating question in general, why people wind up where they do.
Yeah, exactly.
It's, you know, it's one of the central questions for people, you know, if you're a curious person. And, you know, so did somebody else come in?
Yeah, Marco. Hi, Marco.
How come I don't see him? Let's see. Gallery view, maybe, huh? Yeah, there he is. Hi, buddy.
Hello. Good to see you again. I think Doug may be joining us, so we may want to wait a couple of minutes before diving in.
Is Johnny coming on today? I don't know.
I don't know either.
He usually does, but...
He does. Well, let's give it a few minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
See who else shows up.
I'm not in a rush.
We're at the end of summer as well. We have Labor Day coming up in the States on Monday.
Well, here too, yeah.
Oh, really? I didn't know. Yeah.
It's my 3-day novel weekend.
Oh, really? And do you have an idea in mind?
I do. I'm a bit worried because I'm not quite prepared enough for it this year, but, you know, see what comes out. But
How about you, Mark? Oh, you're going to have a backyard barbecue or something?
No, there seem to be a couple of events or invitations going on that were mentioned, but not made concrete. Like, we haven't received any kind of official invitation, but I think one or two things as far as locally we'll do, friends in town, that's it, for the weekend. I don't think so much in terms of the standard holidays. I don't tend to organize my life around them, although I'm aware of them and I, you know, take them into some kind of an account in terms of meshing my own life rhythms, my own life, you know, flows and the things that I'm focused on with what everybody else is doing. And definitely in the course of a week, there's a kind of collective wave pattern, you might say, as you go from Monday to Tuesday to Wednesday. And then that takes place within these kind of larger cyclical cultural patterns. But I find that I don't quite mesh well with the conventional events, the event schedule. I miss birthdays, for example, all the time, even of my dearest family members' anniversaries. They just don't seem to register for me as meaningful. And I haven't, you know, been conscientious enough or exerted enough of an effort to really integrate them into my overall like temporality, which I think, you know, since we're on that topic, I mean, that of course brings to mind Jeffrey's 20-year plans, because that is totally another time scale and horizon for organizing one's life. And I do pay attention to the seasons and the maturation of the summer as it becomes kind of, you know,
it's
ripe.
It's hard not to. Living in Colorado, where the seasons are strikingly, there's, you know, they're different. Mm-hmm. Where in Southern California, paradise, it's just like same.
Yeah, and so I feel like my own creative cycles or my own life projects sort of have to conform to the seasons a little bit. Because in the wintertime, I feel more inward and I feel more kind of underground. And then in the summertime, things start coming out and there's a lot more activity. But, you know, this is, again, part of a larger unfolding. And so the question of how you construct your life or how you articulate your life or your work in time over longer periods of time and how those tie into larger human and historical cycles. I think that's interesting. I think that's the one of the interesting aspects of Jeffrey's project and the things that I'd love to hear about and talk about. But yeah, at the moment it's like the end of summer, and so there's stuff going on. What about you, Mark? What?
Living alone like I do now, it doesn't matter, and none of that stuff. Back when I was younger, and had friends and family, all those markers, yeah, paid attention. But now it's like I lose track of everything. Even a week, Monday doesn't differentiate from Friday, or so the only thing is the stock market, it's closed on the weekend. Bummer. it doesn't, none of that stuff. I don't know, the Thanksgiving to Christmas, it can get a little melancholy,
Mm-hmm. Lonely.
So, huh?
Lonely.
That's a word that works. Yeah.
Okay. So, I think we've already gotten started on the conversation in a way, and I'm not sure anybody else is going
to
join.
Should I just start it? Yeah. I'm hoping to limit my comments to about 30 minutes at maximum. I've got a lot to say, so I'm going to try and keep it down. But we'll see how I do, and maybe I'll try and keep track of the time a bit. So obviously, the main idea, as I was saying to Mark a few minutes ago, the main idea of a 20-year plan is to get a big lever on ambitious goals. Why 20 years? Well, it's kind of a compromise between leverage. Over 20 years, you have a certain amount of leverage and flexibility. 20 years for, if you start early enough, Mark was saying he's not sure he has another 20 years left in him, but if you start early enough, you can get maybe two or three 20-year plans done in life. So you have this possibility of moving from one goal to a different goal and allowing some sort of evolution there and not just around one single goal. So the 20 years is kind of a compromise. But does it have to be 20 years? Could it be 15? Could it be 25? It's not fixed in stone. It's just the way I sort of set it up when I started on this. How leverage? Well, it's sort of an argument against this idea that the single person can't do much. If you do small things today, especially if you reinforce the things that you do over time, then small acts today can have huge consequences the further out you go, especially if they're reinforced. It's much easier to have a big effect over the long term, even from small acts, than it is to have big effects over a short period of time where, you do stuff and it just gets lost in the background noise. But if you consistently go at something over a long period of time, you can get a certain amount of leverage. So that's the idea. There are costs, and I was talking about that with Mark. So you can achieve big goals if you're single-minded enough about them. That is to say, if you start to divide up your big goals into several pots, you can't invest the same amount of effort into each of the different pots. So you want to go one big one. You can have a certain amount of leverage. And I'm going to come to the... I'm just going to run through some of the principles that I'm offering, and then I'm going to go into the personal details afterwards.
But before you do, we're having an audio issue. You sound...
Maybe it's just my.
That's better.
Is it? It may be just the connection. Okay. So this idea of exclusivity, it has to be one big goal or maybe a couple. You need to spend a lot of time on it. So there's time involved. You need to be ready to take advantage of opportunities as you arise, as they arise, because you can't plan it all for 20 years and work that way. You can plan a little bit, but then you have everything is opportunistic. But if you have your goals set out, then when opportunities arrive and they fit with the goals, then you jump on them. And that's how you move things forward. And you have to be persistent over the long term. You have to maintain the goals over the long term in order for it to work. What kinds of goals? Well, anything really, any big goal, provided you understand the costs. So because there are costs involved, you sort of have to make sure that the goal is worth the time and single-mindedness that you need to invest in it in order to achieve the goal. So you're not going to pick trivial things because it takes too much to do it. It takes too much effort and organization to do it. So you're going to pick things that matter to you, you know, that sort of. On the other hand, I wanted to say that you're not going to worry about picking goals that only you can do. As say, you pick the biggest goals that you can think of, even though you as an individual could not possibly achieve them, because you can still get there. And I'll come to that as I go. So you don't have to take the fact that a single person is limited in what they can do as being constraint on setting your goals. You set your goals even if they involve massive societal changes, and you don't worry about the details of it. And we'll come to that as I go. So in terms of process, the process that I followed, so I'm sort of describing the process in more abstract terms, is dream big. So come up with this big dream in color, dream the biggest scale that matters, prioritize the dreams, and choose one that matters. Work out a statement that explains what you're planning to do, so that it makes sense. Then I suggest that you announce your goal to your public, and you have to figure out who your public is. Because when you announce your goal, you make it real. It's not just a hypothetical, maybe I'll do this, but it's like you've engaged yourself with your public to do it. You can work out, clearly it's a 20-year goal, but you can work out 10-year, 5-year, and 1-year plans. But you can't really do that. You can do it as an initial exercise, but you can't expect those plans to work out over time because everything changes as you go. So you have to be careful not to overthink the problem. So the idea is so what I tend to do is I come up a list of actions that I need to take in categories. And some of the actions are shorter term, which I indicate, and some of them are midterm and some of them are longer term. And then you use that list of actions as a kind of a guide as you go forward in life. When I started, I put the statement on a wall. In fact, I had my bedroom, and I made a big poster, and I stuck it on the inside of the bedroom with the bedroom door open so nobody could see the statement. Only I saw the statement when I shut my bedroom at night. So it was just a way of reminding myself about this, about the goal that I was. But over time, it became sort of automatic, and I didn't have to do that anymore. I do try and aim for an annual review every year. I don't always remember, but I do tend to do a 5-year review and a 10-year review in order to see how I'm doing in terms of the goals that I've set out. And then the final, more abstract thing is there are surprises in the process. So the biggest surprise, and it has to do with what I was saying earlier about not limiting yourself to things that only you can do, is that the world moves along with you. And so even though you set out a goal that is far exceeds your capacity to reach it, because the world moves along with you, the capacity to reach it grows because the world is collaborating with you to get there. And so there's this kind of feedback between what you do and what the world does. And it's an unexpected thing. It comes, in my case, it was certainly unexpected. I didn't expect it to happen, but it did. And so I consider it part of the process. So my first 20-year plan was 1990 to 2010. The idea was that I'd ended up in a career in science, but I had artistic leanings from way back. I talked about this as another, I think the last cafe that we had, I talked a little bit about it. And I wanted to find a way to combine the science and the art practice together. So the statement I came up with roughly is combine scientific and artistic practices within a common program, not just personally, but in the research community and in society at large. So this is 1990. If you raised the issue of integrating art into science, you were laughed out of the room. I mean, people used to make jokes about it. I mean, my department head in my department said it's like as if you're going to put a surveyor and a musician together and they were going to work together. This was a joke at the time. Well, today I have projects where surveyors and musicians work together. So I announced the program. I went to a conference, a kind of an unusual conference in Spain in 1990. It involved a number of senior researchers in related areas, and I announced to them that this was my goal for the next 20 years. I did it in a kind of a way. I had to introduce myself, and I introduced myself by writing a little bit of fiction, sort of projecting myself in the future and saying that in 20 years, this is where I was going to be, using a little bit of a fictional piece to describe it. So it was kind of a using fiction to propose something in a professional context. They thought it was cute, but they didn't really know what to do, what anything to do about it. I was a young PhD. I just finished my PhD, a young researcher. I had no background. I had no money. And I did have a position, which was, but it wasn't tenure. It was tenure track, but it wasn't tenured. So I was pretty well a nobody at that point. So the idea that I would take on this task of bringing the arts into the sciences in a substantive way across 20 years, people just thought I was crazy at the time. As I said, I came up with a list of actions. I had, I think, 10 items or 11 items. One was to talk to people about the project. Approach potentially important players, so people who are already active looking at the arts and the sciences, who are already doing something around that. Write some papers or some sort of text about cross-collaboration between the arts and the sciences, because that wasn't obvious how to do that even at the time. Set up some art-science collaborations with people. Challenge funding agencies to change policy, because at the time, the funding agencies also treated the whole problem as a non-starter, and there weren't any mechanisms to fund research that covered arts and the sciences together. So challenging the funding agencies was part of the goal. Developing my own artistic practices, achieve or attain funding in order to support projects that had arts and science components, which obviously depended on changes in the way funding worked in the system. Set up some kind of workshops and work out hybrid art science methodologies, because it wasn't clear how you would even set out to bridge the two disciplines in a kind of formal way. So some sort of methods was important. So that was my list of actions to take. So I got a little bit of traction by talking to people in the first few years, but not a lot. My wife was a poet, and so she and I did some collaborations, early collaborations together, that led to a few things that were developed that way. But in almost for the first 10 years, it was hard to get much traction on the problem. in 1993, I wrote a paper that integrated cultural elements into the surveying, which was my own discipline at the time. In 1995, I wrote papers on design, and I started to attract collaborators who were interested in design. So that was the first significant shift from a kind of engineering, physical science approach to something that was a little bit closer to the arts. Essentially, the big change was that in 1999, I took part in a very large grant application for a pan-Canadian research network. I was co-leader of the application, and it was successful. So it jump-started us into a situation where all of a sudden I was in a position of some influence and some power. And I used that position, first of all, to lobby the funding agencies to get them to change their policies about artistic funding and in its relation to science. They were already thinking about it, but they hadn't done a lot. So when I started to lobby them, it was clear that it wasn't falling on deaf ears, and perhaps the comments that I made towards them had some kind of long-term effect, because within a few years, there were funding opportunities that were developing, allowing one to do this kind of stuff. In 1999, 2000, again, because I was part of this network, there were funding opportunities through the network that were distinct from the funding opportunities that were generally available, that were more flexible and allowed one to develop. So I was able to get some funding to do some design work, and some funding to do work with social scientists and artistic researchers. I also was able to get leverage to get a Canada Research Chair, which is a prestigious Canadian program for funding research. So I was able to secure a Canada Research Chair for myself, which essentially funded me for the next 15 years to do pretty well anything I wanted to. So using that opportunity, I was able then to leverage much more funding in order to develop this process. What else? So in 2003, I met a singer, and she and I, who was fascinated by the art science link up, and she and I ended up collaborating over more than 10 years on a variety of projects that innovated in this area. And so we were able to develop publications and so forth. When my chair came up for renewal in 2006, the second time I put in the application for the chair, the application was focused on art science combined research. And I got funded for the renewal for that project in particular. So by now, at that point, I had now pretty well $100,000 coming in, just focused on art science, $100,000 a year coming in, just focused on art science research. 2006. So we're in the sort of final stages of the first 20-year plan. By the time I got to the end of it, I think 2007 to 2009, I did a year working on sculptures, and then I did a did 2 years teaching myself to sew and then teaching myself to design clothes. So that was the artistic practice coming in, my own artistic practice that I was trying to develop at the same time. So at the end of, oh, and then 2007 onwards, I got invited to joint art science initiatives, including initiatives that were focused on research methods. And so I was also able to get some traction on the issue of methods. So by the end of the first 20-year plan, although I hadn't succeeded everything, on the main points, I got traction on almost everything. The workshops hadn't happened, but it's sort of a lesser important goal. I was funded at this point at about $300,000 a year to do joint art science, which is pretty good, considering where I started. So overall, I felt that I had more or less succeeded. And obviously, the reason I had succeeded was because even though I had done stuff, the world of research was much more accommodating towards these kinds of initiatives than it was when I started. And that wasn't just me. That was because there were lots of people who were concerned about this issue. And so the whole field moved, and not just me. But clearly I had some sort of a role in the process. Around 2007, I started to think about what do I want for my next 20-year plan. And as I mentioned at some point, the issue of spirituality was something that had long been an interest of mine. The integration of the arts and the sciences opens you up to questions about spirituality, because there's a kind of sensitivity in the arts towards opening up those kinds of questions. I grew up atheist, but in my early 20s, I became associated with the Quakers. I never fully became a Christian, but I was always interested in Christian theology, along with other religions, Buddhism, Hinduism, Taoism, and so forth. I was also inspired by Gregory Bateson, who in the latter part of his life developed an interest in religion and the sacred. But I also had my mother later in life became involved in a cult, and it was kind of a meditation cult, but she thought she had the answers, and she tried to sell her kids on the answers. So I had these, she preached at us essentially, and it made me allergic to people who think they have or pretend to have the absolute truth as a result, which is part of what the issue that came out recently on the forum for me was. So the statement that I came to was extend the art-science integration effort that I did in my first 20-year plan to include a greater spiritual grounding in whatever form that might take. Find a way to counter the allergic reaction in science circles to tackling issues of spirit. So it's kind of a double two-level goal. An announcement, I didn't make a formal announcement, but I've announced it pretty well to everybody I know. So it's kind of a more general announcement. My action list is similar to the first one. So talk to a number of people, build on the intersection already established between the sciences and the arts to extend it to include spirituality. Identify and develop collaborators. I had a section where I needed to deepen my philosophical and theological understanding of the questions. So a reading kind of goal. Find a way to integrate spiritual issues into my own artistic practices. Engage with interested and open students. So that was a an issue that comes up in the academic world. Find a community of like-minded individuals. Fund projects to feed this effort and document the process. So kind of it's roughly similar to the first 20-year program. For collaborations, I developed between 2014 and 2018 collaborations with a series of musicians who wanted to develop an opera in that had touched on spiritual issues to some extent, or vulnerability spiritual issues. And so we developed an opera based on my own science fiction work that deal with some of these efforts. Since 2012, I've been reading major philosophers, Deleuze, Whitehead, and then with the group here, Sloterdijk and Gebser. And reading major religious works, including the Bible, the Koran, the Tao Te Ching, Bhagavad Gita, Aurobindo. I'm looking at the Upanishads, but I haven't read it yet. For my art practice, obviously the cycle of novels on science fiction, which deals with spiritual issues as well. And the work recently on quantum poetics that brings in this area of spirituality. In 2015, I took on a PhD student who is interested in integrating spiritual issues into joint art science work. So that's been ongoing for the last 3 years. And obviously 2015 was more or less the year that I engaged with Infinite Conversations, which is the community of like-minded individuals. So to summarize, after 8 years of my second 20-year plan, many unlooked for opportunities. I mean, the whole possibility that came from Infinite Conversations was not originally planned for, but developed as it went along. Many major steps forward in most of the areas that I had identified. I'm still lacking in some areas. Funding is still a problem. Long-term documentation is still a problem. But in the previous 20-year plan, funding and documentation, papers and things didn't really happen until the last 5 to 8 years and not in the first 10 to 12 years. So it may be reasonable that you can't leverage funding too quickly in the process. And also that the current effort has moved well beyond the academic context. And so it's no longer confined purely to the academic world. So it's kind of a quick summary of my own process and how I understand the process in terms of progress I've made and goals that I'm working towards and so forth. I don't know if that was coherent. And I'm open to questions, discussion, whatever anybody wants to bring up. And I think I did it in less than half an hour.
Mm-hmm. Good job. Well, I want to just chart out two possible directions or maybe phases for a conversation about this. Because on the one hand, there is the notion of doing a 20-year plan as a way of organizing your life and your attention and your energies. And you identified certain characteristics of those plans that you've taken on for yourself and aspects of the process and how basically one might go about setting something like that up. And that's, I think, one interesting direction to go in. But then the other is the content of your plans themselves. So first integrating science and art, and then integrating science, art, and spirituality. And what you've learned through that, you know, through actually undertaking these initiatives, and then, you know, how that would, you know, how that interacts with what Mark and myself and others on this particular platform or in the Cosmos Cafe are interested in, because certainly there's a fruitful overlap there. So Mark, what was your what were your reactions, or how did Jeffrey's plans land for you?
Well, it's not unfamiliar to a lot of self-help, I don't know, whatever, a lot, you know, the Four Agreements, the Seven Habits of Success, you know, all these types of books. But then as you told it, you know, I wanted to raise my hand and clarify some things, because I think it's fascinating, and congratulations. I mean, that's pretty amazing to be able to, as you call it, leverage, get people to pay for your experimental processes. A couple early questions, and you probably, one was your age, but you said you were already a young PhD, so you were 24 or something already.
29.
So you were already what a lot of people would call successful. You know, the number of PhD, that's a highly professional career to make it that far. So you were already successful, and then you came up with seems to me a brilliant plan to use other people's money to pursue your ambitions, which is, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, yeah, where's the money come from? Where's the funding come from? And I picked up something, the feedback from the world. I kind of lean towards the law of attraction, and I think this plan fits into that philosophy. Very much so. In other words, all of the steps and everything is, yeah, you have a plan, you focus on it, and it attracts. That's sort of the same thing, the feedback from the world. You get moving in a direction, and you're persistent. But you have to know where you are and what you want and all that. And so I was wondering, you said your mother, at what age was that when your mother got involved in the cult of meditation? You said she started to push that on you and your siblings, and you recoiled from that.
Yeah, I was about 25, I guess, 25, 26.
Living it, I mean, how did that, were you living at home? Was she?
No, I'd left by then, yeah. So it's not, it's just that it was an annoying thing to deal with.
So would she call and?
Yeah,
and
she would call, and she not only that, but she interfered in one of my relationships. She wrote a letter to my girlfriend, and it got into serious difficulties with the relationship as a result. So he wasn't just a sort of, you know, it was a little bit too hands-on.
We're back. We always wind up going back to mother in some way or another, the terrible mother, and I'm not saying that you have those feelings towards your mother, but yeah, everything seems to.
I have mixed feelings towards my mother. I mean, there are downsides, but there are upsides as well, right? So,
life is just very, very complex. You know, in an individual
way. But I agree with you that I started off with a deck of cards that was to some extent already stacked in my favor. I mean, compared to many people, I understand that. Yeah.
But again, I mean, congratulations. I mean, to figure all that out into, that's the proper way to go about.
You know? As we said at the beginning, it depends on what your goals in life are. If you just want to live your life and not worry about things, you're not going to develop that kind of an approach. It's more if you really have an engagement and you want to see something change in the way the world is done, that then, you know. And I must admit, I wondered the question, let's say, instead of the kind of goal that I said, you just set out to cause war. You know, would you be as successful in causing a war, you know, if you went around it systematically? Perhaps you would, I don't know, but you know, it'd be so these are questions I have about whether or not, you know, because in a way I'm kind of generalizing from one case.
Well, that's a inference from the specific to the general, right?
Yes.
As opposed to deduction, where you general to the,
yeah, to the specific. But I mean, inferring from one case is probably not a great idea. It's just that as an example of somebody succeeding in doing something, it could be a source of inspiration. But it's not meant to be a rule book, right?
Well, I think it is, because a lot of, and again, what is success, maybe, but successful people, the guidelines are pretty similar across religion, across culturally, you know, those things that you laid out, those are good, you know, 12 rules for life or whatever, you know, however they frame it. Those things tend to bring positive outcomes. So, and you're another example of that.
But as I say, I'm not good at following recipes, so I'm not really proposing a recipe, although it did sound a bit like that. It's more that, because I never set out to sort of, promote 20-year plans. It's just that they've been successful for me. I brought it up in one of the discussions, and there's been a certain amount of interest on the site to find out more about it. So it's but it's not my goal to promote it. It's more that I think it's interesting to present the case of somebody going through this process, and then people take from it whatever they want. You know, it doesn't have to be of you know, because I myself, if somebody had came up to me and said to do this 20 years ago or 30 years ago, I probably said, I follow my own rules. I don't follow other people's. And that would have been the end of it. You know, I've read lots of the self-help books as well, but the thing I don't like about them is the rules. I don't like the rules. I don't want to follow the rules. So.
Well, there's a certain a lot of these conversations that we're having here, You know, I pop in and out. But the same sorts of conversations I have with my, I call her my psych girl, but and I prefer that format one-on-one, and of course it's bound by confidentiality, so it's very it's a way of talking about these issues, a sort of it's safe. And one of the things we talked about was rule breaking and boundaries, and she's very much bound by the ethics of the profession, and she was questioning my tendency to push boundaries, which is basically that's sort of the creativity spirit, is a person willing, or I think you can't really help yourself, that you push against the rules, and that's almost the definition of creativity. If you stay bound within the rules, things stay the same.
So I'm curious, maybe to pick up on that and tie back to the idea of doing a 20-year plan like this, which is an extraordinary thing to do. And I think is part of what you're saying too, Mark, that you know, not everybody projects themselves into the future and lines up and orients their life, lines up, you know, their life situation, their arrangements, and orients their activities on a day-to-day basis around this very transcendent objective. And so one of the things I noted is that there's costs to this, right? Because you are dedicating time, energy, resources toward this transcendent goal, there's other things that are not receiving your attention or your presence or what have you. And then this plan arises in a moment in your life when you want to, I'm projecting a little bit into your situation, but respond to, react against, or transcend certain constraints that you feel on your situation. So I wonder if you could say more about, how does this goal that you set for yourself relate to other goals in your life or other conditions in your life that would make it a priority, that would make it important to cast yourself?
So it's a good question, because at one point when I was thinking about my second 20-year plan, I was thinking, you know, I'm single. I've been single for a while. Maybe my 20-year plan would be no longer to be single in 20 years, you know, which might be, you know, but I think part of my, anyway, maybe, I don't know if it's personal exactly, but my experience with the first 20 years, so when I started, it was the year I got married, 1990. By the end of the 20 years, I was no longer married for reasons that had nothing to do with anything that I could have done anything about, because my wife died of cancer. So it wasn't anything that I could have changed in any easy way. So I sort of came to the conclusion that although you could pick a goal like that, that life doesn't, you don't control those aspects of life. And maybe it's not a good thing that you could control them, or that you try to control them. And so I was sort of more interested in these larger questions and let the relationship issues go into the background, work themselves out as they needed to, rather than make them explicit as a long-term goal, for instance. But, you know, I could quite understand somebody else picking something like that as being their goal over a long period of time. I don't know if 20 years is necessary to find a relationship, but so I don't know if that answers your question, Marco, but it certainly situates perhaps one alternative thinking about the long-term goals.
I guess the other part of it is that you're situated at this point as a professor in university in a particular department, and you want to do work that goes outside of the boundaries of that department. So you want to you want to establish a career path for yourself or a creative path for yourself that is not available in the standard options.
Yep.
So this is also part of what I'm guessing motivates you to set up this, you know, this whole structure to potentially shake things up or to forge your own path when none is there. And I'm remembering as well the sessions we did on the minor gesture with Erin Manning, and in that book she talks about this concept of research creation, which I hadn't heard of before, but is a term that is used to describe, I think, what you were talking about in terms of your first year plan as doing art and science at the same time, and how, you know, that has taken on a certain politics. It's become a term that you could use to raise money, for example. So there's been a shift in the climate or in the sensibility or the sensitivity of the funding agencies or the university to, you know, what academics are interested in doing. And they've begun orienting around these terms that kind of give it a place within the system. But she was also arguing against some of the limitations that have kind of been imposed on even that term. So was that something that came out of, I mean, would you describe yourself as part of the movement to change the way that, you know, that kind of work is funded?
Well, it's the kind of extension of the 20-year first one, because the first 20-year plan, unlike the second one, was situated within academia. I mean, it was a goal within academia because when I started, there wasn't a lot of opening for any of this. And research creation is interesting because it's a term that came out of the French. It's actually a translation of recherche création, which is the French term for this combination of research and creative, often creative writing, but not necessarily creative writing. But so there's a counter, you know, often like there often is for movements, there's an academic movement for it, but there's also counter movements and critical contexts around some of the ways it's being officialized, right? Which is part of what Erin is talking about in the minor gesture. And certainly I fit in both. I probably fit in more on Erin's kind of end of that than the official. I always tend to be with the underdog, I think, but or the maverick is tend to be the kind of role that I tend to play. So, but the second plan is clearly, as you say, an attempt to exceed the academic context in ways that are because I think the issues are broader than just academia. The issue around spirituality is, it's tricky. It's a delicate subject to deal with. Because people get very, it's one of the things that I know is people get very upset very quickly about issues within the subject of religion, perhaps more than spirituality per se, but certainly within religion. We saw that on the forum again recently. So it's a tricky subject to deal with. A kind of almost a paradoxical subject to deal with, you know, because there's as much against dealing with it as, and you have to be conscious of the paradoxes in order to deal with it successfully. So, not sure how that answers, but.
Well, I mean, science and art, they both fall well within the purview of the university, the modern university, anyway. So it's not surprising that it would be possible, and within a short time span, that, you know, funding opportunities, collaborations, programs could arise that make that a theme. I think that there are plenty of people who identify as both scientists and artists, or if not scientists and artists, artistic and rational or scientific in their thinking, way of being. But I think, as you say, it's true that spirituality is doesn't really have a place in the modern university, other than as an adjunct to it. I mean, there are chapels.
Well, there are campus and groups. Yeah, but there's a faculty of theology, for instance, at our university, and I tried to approach the faculty of theology. It was very hard to find somebody who would engage. The one I did engage with one person, but they ended up not exactly preaching at me, but almost. It was kind of a moral criticism, because I wasn't following a strictly Christian process in what I was proposing to do. And she was Catholic, and she thought, you know, so she sort of dealt with me as if I was somehow some sort of persona non grata. You know, it's like I wanted an open discussion, and what I got was a moral diatribe, you know. So it's been hard to engage with, even in the university environment, with theology people in a way that is really open.
Well, theology is a particular discipline, and it's distinct from religion as a belief system, as well as from spirituality as an identity or a practice. And there are folks who would consider themselves spiritual practitioners or devotees, or you know, what have you, with respect to a particular faith or path or guru or whatever, who can't really be open about that in their religious studies department or in the theology department, because there is the expectation of a theoretical distance on the subject, even though in your case you ran into a kind of dogma in the colleague. But this is different. So I think part of what is difficult about the subject is defining terms to begin with, because people, you know, some people identify as religious, some people identify as spiritual but not religious. I think that there may be potentially a movement that is spiritual and religious, and that has a kind of universalistic or ecumenical or meta perspective on religions and different kinds of paths. But I would be curious to know more about how your understanding of spirituality began in this process, and how it's changed, if it has, in the course of your investigations and your work.
Like, the really easy questions to answer, Marco.
Sorry.
I'm not sure where I would go to begin to answer a question like that. I guess what I have to say, and it's I've already said it in a way, but it was this sensitivity to the paradoxes involved in the question. That is to say, in the questions around spirituality and religion. So You know, for instance, what I said about the relationship with my mother and the fact that she, what she kind of suggested was that she had, she knew the truth. And so she tried to get us to do things in our lives that would allow us to be more open to the truth as she saw it. But she didn't, she wouldn't accept the idea that there was anything wrong with the idea, or that there was anything questionable about the idea that she had the truth. You know, that you know, the idea that if everybody's idea of God is true, and they all contradict each other, that there's no problem, you know, or that there. So this kind of question. So it. You know, I don't like absolutes. I don't like any suggestion of absolutes. And so I'm sort of trying to do things in a way that is recognizes the relativity of different ideas about religion. But of course, you get into trouble with that as well. So, because and maybe that goes back to my roots, because I was raised atheist. My parents were, well, at the time my mother was considered herself atheist. It was only later that she became religious, and my father was also considered himself atheist. And so we grew up in a kind of a questioning environment about religion in general. And so as a young man, I became involved, as I mentioned, with the Quaker movement. And what I liked about the Quakers is that they don't, even though in principle they're a Christian group, they don't. To become a member of a Quaker, they're not called churches; they're called meeting houses or. But to become a member of a Quaker meeting house, it depends on the meeting house, but there are some that don't require that you profess faith to the Christian church at all. Some do and some don't. And so within the Quaker movement, there's a lot of room to be not a Christian and yet still welcome and present and active and involved. And for somebody like me, who had this very sort of eclectic background, it was easy for me to integrate within the Quaker context because there was such an openness towards it. Now, why would I, if I was grew up atheist, would I want to be associated with a religious group at all? Well, by this time, I'd been involved in nonviolent action against the Trident missiles in the United States and sort of the nuclear context. And the process of nonviolent engagement had led to a sort of an awakening within myself that maybe there was something else going on than just the facts and the experience and whatever that. There was some other, so this idea of the numinous or whatever going on. And, but I've never been comfortable with any of the standard religions in relation to it. So I'm not sure if that, again, it's an attempt to come up with an answer to your question, Marco, but it's hard to name, it's hard to describe, it's hard to identify what's going on there. But that was where I became aware that spirituality is an issue, this sort of opening within was something that was interesting to explore with relation to different religions, with the relation to different people, with different approaches and so forth.
I something just popped into my head. And that is ways of knowing. There's three ways of knowing. One is religion, one is science, and one is art, and you're trying to fit those all into some kind of meaningful thing that explains three distinct ways of knowing. So it wouldn't be surprising that there's a lot of resistance.
I mean, I have been an integrator all my life. So, you know, what you're saying describes me to a T.
Well, it's very consonant with the kind of the popular integral ideas that Ken Wilber has promoted, but he points to in other places, I think, you know, accurately, which is as simple as those three ways of knowing. It's art and morals and science, the good, the true, and the beautiful. The good being a correlate of the morals, the beautiful being a correlate of art, and the true being a correlate of science. And so these modes of activity, scientific activity, religion as having something to say about morals or ethics or how we live, or and then art as the creative activity that brings forth the aesthetic or dimension or beauty, that combining all of those is the integral embrace. And hey, so we're gonna have to catch you up, but yeah,
you'll have to.
Okay, well, Jeffrey did a presentation on his 20-year plans, and then Mark and I have been questioning him, thinking about different aspects of this story.
Putting his feet to the fire.
Yeah, and we've just got, you're probably joining at a good time, because we just started talking about spirituality and about the integration of art, science, and spirituality, which Jeffrey is undertaking, proposing as part of this second of his 20-year plans. And so I just asked him the kind of difficult question, which is what was his starting point, basically? And then what has he been learning in the process of pursuing this plan? And you started in 2000, your first 20-year plan ended in 2010. So the second one began just after that, 2000.
Yeah.
So you're coming up on almost halfway.
Yeah.
And then you found us on Infinite Conversations, and that's been one piece of your overall process. But you are also writing your novel, which involves future religions that have particular theologies and particular draw on aspects of contemporary religions to extrapolate what they might look like in thousands of years when humanity is in a completely different, has basically colonized some a larger part of space. So then what you were last saying was that it's difficult and tricky and to talk about spirituality because of paradoxes involved with them, and because of the allergy that you've experienced with respect to the absolute, or people that argue for an absolute with a particular version of truth that they claim they have. So, looks like are you back here? Hey, Katina, can you hear us? All right, I see you there, I don't hear you. I see a placeholder for you. So I would Let me return the question to you, Jeffrey, and ask you to elaborate a bit on what you see as the difficult paradoxes in talking about spirituality or even doing what you're attempting to do. And maybe we should also check in with Katina, because she, I would like for her to be able to respond. To it. I want to make sure she can hear it. Let's do a quick chat.
Well, it gives me a chance to think about it for a moment.
That's probably a good idea. Hey, Katina. There you are. So you got two screens. I'm going to close one of them.
And she seems to be on mute too.
Frozen.
Oh, there, you're moving very, very slightly. I'm going to stop her video and see if that works. Hey, can you hear us, Katina? I just stopped your video.
Hello? Hi, I'm sorry. I'm having some tech difficulties.
I could hear you now. You're kind of fuzzy.
But
can you hear us?
I can now. I had some problems just now. I had to switch the audio over, audio settings on my computer. Now I'm fine.
Well, it seems to be working now. And did you catch my sort of attempt at a summary?
I'm sorry, and I apologize for being late. I'm sorry. I didn't catch your summary.
All right, well, I'll let Jeffrey then do it this time.
Thank you. Hi, Jeffrey. Hi, Mr. G.
You're about passing the back, Marco.
Oh, wow.
Gee, summary. So the question is,
I'm really looking about the long now.
So the question Marco asked me is, because I talked about the paradoxes of talking about religion and spirituality, and he wants me to talk something about what I mean by paradoxes, I think, which is tricky because I'm not quite sure what I meant myself by it. So,
well,
but I mean, but I think there are contradictions. So it's like spirituality and religion are different. People have, as we saw recently, people have a kind of a very personal, they often have a very personal connection to the religion within which they were raised, for instance. So we saw that with J.F. Martel, who commented about the fact that he was raised within the Catholic religion and he had some issues with the discussion as a result of that. So you can easily step on people's sensitivities with a very basic discussion about religion. So it's like a minefield of issues to sort of get into talking about religion and spirituality in an open exchange way without bringing up all sorts of triggers that go off in other directions. And I mean, I don't know what the answer to that problem is, but I think it's certainly on a site, and you know, and think, Marco, in your response to one of Katina's messages, you mentioned that, you know, we have this other discussion with people who are Aurobindo adepts on the site. And they also have, they're not exactly religious issues, but they are sensitivities around the discussion of particular ideas about religion that can also be problematic. And so, you know, Infinite Conversation is a site where we try to discuss these things in this sort of open forum way, but it's so easy to step on toes without meaning to. I perhaps I'm exaggerating, but that's a bit my
view. Not at all.
And it would be nice to find a way to be able to talk about it more open, more freely, without getting stuck into those kinds of things. And that, in a way, is part of, so I mentioned in my statement that I want to see about developing, for instance, more of an opening towards spirituality, for instance, within the academic or within the scientific research community, which is quite allergic to any discussion about spirituality. I was just reading, I think, in an article today that something like, 86% of the world follows a religion. In the science world, 68% follow religion, 63%.
Can you repeat that, Jeffrey? You said that...
I'll have to find the reference. It was a newspaper article. I think it was in The Guardian. So it was an article saying that 86% of the world follows a religion. Okay. In science, 63% of sciences also follow a religion. Now, that's way down from 86%, but it's way up from the sort of 30% that people have been talking about in the science world. So even in the science world, there are lots of people who are religious, maybe closet religious, but don't talk about it much. So,
why do you think they don't talk about it much?
Because there's a culture in science that spirituality is somehow not part of the conversation. And so in order to bring it into the conversation, somehow you have to address these issues that all the sensitivities, and of course it's hard to address the sensitivities. So I'm not sure what the answers are, but those are part of the questions that I have that I'm interested in exploring and developing. Is that an answer, Marco, for?
Yeah, I think it's a start. I mean, it seems to me part of the reason why spirituality is not part of the conversation, or why it's difficult to make it part of the conversation in the sciences, is because it derails the conversations that scientists want to have. Because it is so easy to offend and to upset and to incite anger in others when you talk about matters of ultimate concern. And so if you're there to work on a particular problem, whether it's in nuclear physics or astrophysics or biology or whatever it is, and people want to bring religious questions into it from, I think, the reality of the research program you may have in mind, it muddies the waters, is my sense for what might be behind that.
But it depends on the research question.
Venue where you can even have the conversation.
It depends on the research question, because if you're working, as I do, in research that has to do with joint application of the arts and the sciences, you already have an opening to talk about some of those issues. So if you're trying to do standard astrophysics, you're right. But if you're trying to do something that is a little bit more human, social, whatever, it's not so clear cut, So, and more of science is going that way than used to. I mean, even in the medical field, where people want things to be cut and dried, it's hard to be cut and dried,
Mm-hmm. May I respond, Mr. Jeffrey?
Please do.
No, I think that's an excellent observation, and it's a big problem, and I think it's a hindrance, especially in the sciences, because I definitely think that we need to separate religion from spirituality, because they are two separate animals. I mean, they really are. And, you know, some have said, when they try to simplify the differences, they've said that religion sort of tells you, attempts to tell you the truth, and spirituality sort of just lets you discover it, right? And science, I believe that science and spirituality share that objective. You know, spirituality is more, I think, more about discovery, just as science is about discovery. And I know I've read a lot of scientists who, in their practice, came to develop a spiritual nature, or a spirituality, or a religion, even though I don't use that, but they developed sort of like a spiritual nature through their interaction with their scientific research or scientific inquiries. It revealed to them, you know, it sort of like science was a source of revelation of the spiritual to some scientists, physicists especially. And I don't know. I wish we could get rid of the word religion, because once you get into the discussion, it does trigger a lot. But religion has got a very nasty, like, stigmatized connotation to it, you know, the word. And even Christ didn't like religion, okay? And I think that it's really important to separate the two. I think that they're different, that they're very different. And if we did talk more about spirituality instead of religion, if we try, you know, maybe starting with changing the way that we talk about it, you know, just getting rid of the term religion and talking about it in terms of spirituality, and then look for what science and spirituality have in common, which is this motivation to discover truth, which I don't think religion has that. I think religion is sort of gets people stuck in the truths, like you said, that they were culturally fed or that they grew up with. Religion doesn't really encourage you to seek the truth. It just tells you, here's the truth, you know, believe it. And so I think it is important to separate the two and maybe talk about spirituality more than religion, not even use them in the same sentence. That's what I think.
I like that. I like that idea of discovery as opposed to
Well, that's what science and spirituality have in common. I think science is very spiritual. It's a very spiritual, you know, activity. Or, you know, to me, scientists really, you would think, would be the most spiritual people on the planet, because just the laws, the laws of nature that they're seeking. And in some spiritual practices, you know, they say that, I know in some spiritual practices it said that that it is characteristic of a god to conceal a thing, and then it's characteristic of kings to seek it out, okay? And I think that's what scientists do. I think that's the nature of what you all do, is you are trying to discover and have, yeah, trying to not just through revelation, but trying to discover yourself, you know, the truths and the laws of nature that are set forth in creation. I know if I were a scientist, wow, I would be super spiritual, because it's like, you know, you have, just through the instruments you use, you have just like, you have this window open to you. Even when people look under microscopes and they see microorganisms, and they see the way that, and that when chemists can see the way that electrons and neutrons interact, it's like, that's crazy. That's amazing. That's like a whole different world. Like, I remember watching like a medical school, it was a medical school teaching video. And it was using computer art to explain how blood cells, or what happens when a cut is healing. And it shows, you know, how all the little blood cells and skin cells come in and they regenerate. And I was looking and I was like, whoa, that is like magical. You know, that is so, it was almost like within the human body, what scientists have discovered, that there's a whole different universe going on within the way that the body and the anatomy functions and sustains itself. So, you know, and these are things that, you know, they say that faith is the evidence of things unseen, the evidence of things hoped for, the substance of things unseen. But scientists get a view into the unseen world. You know, I mean, I know if I were a scientist, my faith would be like a catapult through the roof, because they just have this gifted special insight into the world, into the different layers that make up the known world. You know, I think it's amazing. I'm surprised that there was, and see, that's what religion did. That's what religion does, it takes this, if anything, I think religion robs spirituality. You know, it robs us of spirituality. I think it's taken, religion and science have become like, you know, they've locked horns, because I think religion tries to impose on what science is trying to do. I think that science is completely consistent with God's will. I think he wants us to discover, you know, the world and how it functions. So yeah, I wish there was a way that science and spirituality could sort of have a better relationship, because I think if they did, it would probably, you know, it would probably advance our scientific discovery, just, you know, like tenfold, I think. So yeah, I think you make a really good point with that.
Well, Nietzsche argued, and I think others have argued as well, that Christianity was what prepared the West for science, because it instilled a faith in people in an unseen world. So once you have once you become sensitive to, or you're open to the idea that there is a reality beyond or behind or beneath the reality that you can see with your senses, and then you can start doing science, because science is all about a faith in an unseen reality, in the deeper layers of reality that you don't just see with your senses, but which are accessible via your senses.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's interesting. I think also that that the realm of the senses, the realm of what you can see, hear, you know, what we have accessible to us phenomenologically, that we take in and then with reason construct, like, this is how it works, this is why it appears that way. Why does the sun appear to go up and down? The scientific explanation gives a more coherent account for that than the naive perception would suggest, that the earth is going, you know, the sun is going around the earth. But I think what's interesting, like, from the spirituality perspective, is that, you know, it's said that that science begins in wonder, because you wonder, you know, how is it that things are the way that they are, and then that opens into the quest. But I think historically science becomes kind of fixated on a set of acceptable procedures for that, and a set of acceptable evidence for that as well. Whereas spirituality kind of goes into, or allows or permits, other kinds of evidence. So it's not just what would appear to your eyes or your ears or to your sense organs, but also what would appear to interior perception or an interior intuition. And that, I think, is the difficult part, because I could see a tree. I could see a tree outside of my house, and then I could investigate it through all kinds of scientific means to get at smaller and smaller bits of what the tree is. It's made of wood. Wood is made of molecules. Molecules are made of atoms. Atoms are made of quarks. And I can go down and down and down. And that is completely dependent upon that external observation of the tree. Right. There might be another way of experiencing the tree that doesn't involve subdividing it down into its component parts or into the particular mathematical or biological or physical laws that make it appear the way it does, but that relate to it in a different way, relate to it as perhaps a person or as a consciousness or as a spiritual energy or substance or intelligence.
Right.
And those are the I think the realms of data and evidence that are more difficult to address within the scientific context as it is currently constructed. So what would it take to expand the realm of what's considered acceptable evidence, what's considered acceptable mm-hmm. phenomena within a scientific purview.
Yeah, well, science, because when you talk about the spiritual experience, you're talking about a kind of introspective experience. And of course, science operates by avoiding introspection. Introspection is allowed in certain kinds of methodologies, but it's always very constrained and structured in what you're allowed to do in an introspection context. One of the things that we're looking at that in the research context that I'm working with, because we're working at the boundary between the arts and the sciences, is that the artistic experience is much more singular than is the scientific experience. And so what we're trying to look at is a way to develop a kind of a scientific understanding of singularity that could be used as a bridge between artistic perceptions and scientific perceptions, because in a way we're kind of doing, it may be impossible, but there are things about the process that are interesting where we're trying to, in a sense, generalize from a singularity. But there's, you know, and that's a paradoxical subject, but it is a paradoxical subject that has interesting properties to it. And so in that kind of way, there may be a possible anchoring for dealing with issues of spirituality. On the other thing what I wanted to say about religion is, I agree with you, Katina, there are lots of downsides to religion, but there are some upsides to religion. And one of the upsides to religion that became very clear to me a number of years ago is that religion creates communities, and religious communities are by far the most stable communities that human beings can create. They are far more stable than any other kind of basis for a community. And so it's always impressed me that religions do that so well. And it's always been of interest to me is, you know, if you could figure out what makes them so successful, maybe you could apply that to other contexts. But of course, part of the success has to do with the way belief works and the way faith works. And so, you know, that's part of what makes these communities so long lasting, you know? So.
Yeah, that's an excellent point about religion. Yeah, it does create communities, but if you go into those communities, you'll discover another difference between religion and spirituality, which is that sometimes these communities are acceptable, are successful because there's a lot of fear, you know? There's a lot of fear. Maybe, you know, creating laws with consequences and with, you know, I think religion is able to do that because they use fear a lot, and they use fear. They take the doctrines and they squeeze out certain laws that are impossible to. That certain laws and certain ways of living, certain ethics and morals that are really possible to sustain, okay, that are possible to carry, impossible to carry out. And they have consequences associated, not just external, but internal, like your conscience gets like battered and you develop guilt and what have you. And then you develop a fear. There's a fear. And it's not reverential fear. It's a fear of the forces that maintain the laws of this community. And so I don't, yeah, right. I definitely agree that religions have this uncanny way of developing these seemingly stable communities. But I think that at the core of it, there's a lot of instability because there's fear. I think that there's a lot that they're governed by fear, which is, you know, spirituality doesn't deal with fear like religion does. There's no when you look at the differences between them. I don't mean to sound like poetic or whatever, but you know, spirituality is more based on love rather than fear. Okay, you know, fear with religion, you have fear of the consequences of your actions, which is a wonderful, you know, which is for a community, yeah, you've got internalized fear of breaking the laws or breaking or consequences of your actions. So it's easy to take that and develop stable communities if everybody is has this internalized self-governing fear of what may happen if you break the rules, what may happen after you die, you know, or if you don't live your life accordingly. And, you know, with spirituality, because like Marco said, and this is one of the problems that you're going to have with bringing together spirituality and science, is that with science, yes, it is a spiritual endeavor, but it has, there are rules, there's a scientific method, there's a certain, you know, process, there's a quantitative aspect to it that is crucial, right? And whereas with spirituality, there are really no rules. You just, again, I don't want to sound like, you know, like some fairy tale, but with spirituality, you know, you simply follow your heart. It encourages you to listen to your intuition, and there's a freedom that comes with it. And the reward of spirituality is your own inner happiness, you know? So I do agree that religion do develop communities, but when you get into those communities and look at what's motivating everyone to do the right thing, I mean, that's the goal of spirituality, is intrinsic motivation. It's like, you know, one of the problems I have with religion is that there's this external, most of it is an external motivation wherever people are in the spiritual walk. And that's what's funny. One of the big terms we use in religion, in the world of religion, is spiritual maturity. So within religion, you have this gauge, the second gauge they use. Okay, fine, you're a religious person. Okay, you go to church. But that's not the end of it. Within this religious domain of community, where are you in your level of spiritual maturity? You know, so religion tries to play with maturity and sort of like prostitute it for its own, like, I'm sorry to use that word, you know, before, you know, to fulfill its own, like, objectives or whatever. Whereas I think that there aren't any rules to spirituality, like there are when it comes to science. And so, you know, there's a way that science, now we could see, and then when you start to develop limits or rules for spiritual exploration, then you fall into religion, you know? And so yet spirituality is a lot more, relevant to science than religion is, you know? And so you have this, but you can't apply any rules to spirituality like you have to in science. And that's where I think there needs to be some type of way to bridge that. But I think you make a good point about.
So I do agree that religions include a lot of fear, but I also think that there are attempts to create communities, for instance, by dictators, based almost entirely on fear. And those communities don't survive. Religious communities have this mix of fear and, as you mentioned, love or belief or faith. Mm-hmm. And it's the mix that makes them sustainable. I don't disagree that the fear isn't there. I agree that often you dig underneath and there's all sorts of tensions going around in these communities. Mm-hmm. But they nonetheless persevere. And there's something very interesting about that.
You're right. That's right. Yeah, that's interesting.
So just abstracting from the points you each made, I want to propose a very minimalistic and very tentative just theory about what we're talking about and how we might parse things mm-hmm. a bit. We're talking about spirituality and religion and fear and love. And also the individual and the group. So it seems to me that spirituality, as we're talking about it here, I'm not trying to say a bigger theory or anybody else, just as we're talking about it here, is more individual, and it's not bound by the rules of the collective. That's what I'm hearing.
Right.
Religion is a group.
Internalized.
Did you say internalized? And religion.
Yeah, with spirituality.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And religion involves a social group. It involves rules. It involves fear, or a mix of fear and hope. You didn't use that word hope, but I think that that's what we're, you know, that's implied by the hope for an afterlife or for what have you.
Yeah.
But then there was this, the part of the paradox, I think, is that when what happens when spirituality becomes social? Does it automatically become, when spirituality becomes social? In other words, when spirituality is practiced in a group, does it necessarily become religious? Does it necessarily have to bring rules and bring common norms or mores or other binding features? That's one question I want to raise.
One response to that is, I mean, in a sense, that's what the Quakers are. The Quakers, each person experiences their own spirituality, and what meeting for worship consists of is the sharing of each person's individual sense of spirituality with the group, and all of their structures are bottom up. Everything moves upward from the meeting for worship, and so all the structures and organizations are organized anchored on the individual experience of spirituality. So there's something very interesting about the Quakers in that particular context.
But aren't the Quakers decreasing as a group or something, where other religions like the Mormons are growing and growing, and the Quaker societies are almost extinct? They're getting smaller and smaller and smaller.
I don't know if they're extinct, but they've never been.
No, not extinct, but they're contracting, getting smaller rather than expanding.
I don't know. I could talk to Doug maybe a bit about it, but I think it's been pretty stable for a pretty long time, and they're never going to be hugely popular, but they are. I mean, you know, the issues about the growth of religion, it has to do with what Katina is talking about, the fear, and the fear driving, of course, is related to religion offers certainty.
Well, I think
that's more part of the problem. So
I think more than fear or hope, religions provide order.
Yes, order and certainty.
Yeah.
And we live in a world where we need.
That's comforting to people.
Yes, clearly.
Yeah, very. Yeah, exactly. Right.
Yeah, certainty.
And we live in a world where uncertainty is on the rise, so there's a tendency for people to withdraw into enclaves where there's a certain amount of certainty. Over the long term, one can hope that that isn't necessarily the long-term tendency, but right now it seems to be the way it's going.
Yeah, that's a really good point. That religion does offer incredible certainty for here and the hereafter. And how do you compete with that? You know, I mean, it's like, but I still think that we need to get rid of the term, and we need to start using the terminology of spirituality more. Yes, what I heard Marco saying when he was starting to summarize was, what's interesting is, even though religion is incompatible with science and spirituality is more compatible with science, the fundamental aspect of science that gives it its credibility is the idea of using order, of rules, of data, of quantitative analysis. And religion, being a vehicle of order, would seem to be more compatible with science. Yet when you put them together, it's like a nuclear holocaust. They both sort of like, both sides sort of like, you know, they destroy each other. Yet spirituality, even though it's seemingly more consistent with science, because of the exploration, you know, the we were saying that, the idea of discovery, it's motivated by discovery and by, like Mark was saying, the sense of wonder in science that motivates you to go out and like immerse your senses into whatever phenomenon you're trying to like discover. And that is definitely consistent with spirituality. Yet spirituality lacks the, because it is so limitless, it lacks the rules or the methodology, the concrete type of set of order that science relies on. And yet religion offers this order. But this order is antithetical to science. So either way, I think we still need to get rid of religion and find a way. Maybe it involves making, because you cannot apply rules to spirituality.
That's gonna be very hard if, and I think it's true what Jeffrey said, that 86% of the 7 billion people attach themselves to the order of a particular religion. And so when you say you want to get rid of it, good luck with that.
Okay, I don't mean religion. Yeah, you're right. I don't mean get rid of religion. I mean, I'm talking about the terminology, okay? I'm talking about, like, identifying, all right, when we use the word religion, then to make sure that we are not, it's not synonymous, it's not, we're not using it like synonymously with spirituality. That's what I'm saying. I'm saying that get rid of the terminology of religion when we're talking about spirituality. That's what I mean. I know that sounds really ridiculous. Not get rid of religion, duh. I mean, like, you know, get rid of the association associated with spirituality. Because I haven't been involved in religious communities and very active participating in them. A lot of religious communities don't stress spirituality as much as they should. From what I've seen, I mean, that's like after the fact or afterthought or something. Or it's something that religious people think is automatically going to develop through the religious life. And that's why there's so many people who are religious, yet they're not spiritual. And in the religious community, we refer to that as lost, I guess, you know. Thanks for making that distinction. I meant to say that, you know, we need to get rid of associating the term religion with the term spirituality, because they really don't have a lot in common. They're almost like opposites in a way, or sort of like two faces of the same coin. The one is looking backward and one is looking forward, like Janus faced. But I think of science, if we find a way to merge science and spirituality, man, this world would it would set us on another plane. We would probably discover new dimensions and be able to harness energy. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that Octavia Butler, I think, is getting at with her Earth Seed and her Parable of the Talents, where it looks like in Parable of the Talents, they eventually achieve that, you know. And I think that is the missing link, so to speak, from science. I think that science and spirituality, you know, they could be BFFs, they could be best friends. They need to work together. But then there's there's a point where science has to depart from spirituality. And in that departure, you kind of have to wonder, you know, what goes on there. So, you know, but thanks for making that. Thanks for making that distinction. You're right. We can never get rid of religion. I'm sorry, Marco.
I think you're making a really good point, which has to do, you said, with terminology, and I think by extension, language, because it's hard to talk about spirituality without confusing people who associate it with a whole bunch of different religious kind of ideas.
Right. And
I think that this is just, I'll have to explore this, but that you can't separate them so much, because that is to say religion and spirituality, like that there's, it's hard to get a clear cut distinction because they're both dealing with matters of concern, matters of spirit, matters of inner concern. Life, death,
and faith. Yeah,
faith. Mm-hmm. What's real? what happens mm-hmm. when we die, etc. Those are the kinds of questions that they're both concerned with. So that they have overlapping domains. The other thing is that they're both also arising. They're aspects of a human situation. They're aspects of our condition. And you know, I've come across recently some like evolutionary psychology is probably the right name for the field, that looks at what role does religion play in human survival and adaptation to changing conditions in their social and ecological life. And how is it that some religions confer a survival advantage and a long-term thriving to a community of people, and therefore play a role in their evolution and in the evolution of the human species, because then there becomes a feedback effect where the ideas of that particular religion, as they grow and amplify and spread, affect how people live and, you know, the genetic selection of who lives and dies. So I think that's a very interesting point of view, because if we take ourselves back to like the primal condition where we are, you know, where we don't have the apparatus of modern technology and economics and society and all the things that buffer us from our potential death at like any moment, then the idea of having a cohesive framework of ideas, signs, rules, punishments and rewards to prevent people from doing stupid things that get the group in trouble and get themselves, you know, prevent genetic propagation, and encourage them to do the things that increase unity, coherence, and even at the expense of, and usually at the expense historically of excluding everybody who doesn't belong to the group. Like that's another feature of it, but
you're right. Yeah.
To be the chosen group, to be the ones who share the privileged relationship to truth or to the absolute, that arguably confers an evolutionary advantage to that group.
And that's a characteristic of religion, right?
That's correct.
What you just described.
Correct.
It's very exclusivist too. And that goes back to what Jeffrey was saying. Yeah, it is interesting. There is some value in looking at religion. And you're right, Mark, you can't separate religion and spirituality, unfortunately, but there needs to be some way to better define the two and to look at how they overlap. And then same thing with science. There's a point of departure from spirituality with science, which has to do with, because spirituality can't be bound by the same rules that scientific inquiry has to sort of, you know, subscribe to. But religion has a point of departure from spirituality also. Though they overlap and they have a lot of things, they're intertwined in a lot of ways. Yeah, you can't ever separate them. But there is a point of departure with spirituality and religion.
So I wanted to bring it back to my second 20-year plan, since I was careful when I made the statement not to put religion into the statement. So let me reread the statement, because you were out anyway. So extend the art-science integration effort to include a greater spiritual grounding in whatever form that might take. Find a way to counter the allergic reaction in science circles to tackling issues of spirit. So that's my second 20-year plan. And it doesn't mention religion, even though in my own writing on the science fiction epic, religion comes up all over the place. But it's the focus is on the spirituality. And obviously, as Marco has said, it's linked to the religion. But my focus is not so much on religion, but on spirituality.
And I like that the way in itself is a human being. Yeah.
I like and the I way you describe it as a discovery. I think that's very good.
To bring it back to Wilbur and integral theory, his latest paper that he wrote about the post-truth world, and he talked about how things have fallen apart because this idea that that truth is relative and an interpretation, and if everybody's interpret manifestation of reality is true, then that collapses into nihilism and you've got chaos. And I think he was right on that. That's what's sort of happening with this global interconnected community. There's this idea that, oh, what anybody says is true. And they all have their own personal reality and there are no rules. And then it just, everything falls apart.
I don't quite agree with that, but I and I haven't read Wilbur either. So when you say bring it back to Wilbur, for me, that's a non sequitur.
Well, that's just that. That's what you're doing when you
beauty all that.
Yeah,
the three ways. I don't think because truth has a certain relative aspect, which I think is true. I don't think just because truth can vary from one individual to another or one context to another, it does not mean there is no common truth. And you know, that it's just anything goes regardless of who says what. I don't think the one implies the other. You're sort of saying it's all or nothing. Either there's one absolute truth or there's just no absolute truth and everything is individual. I don't think so. I think there's a middle ground there.
Well,
I agree with what the, are you Mark?
Yes.
I'm sorry, I'm Katina. You're Mark Ward, sir?
Mark Edward, right?
Said.
Mark Edward Jabor.
Oh, I'm sorry, Edward. Okay, yes. So I'm sorry, Mr. Jabor. I agree with what you said. Without Wilbur, whoever he is, sorry, I respect that that's what the source you're using, but no, I agree with you. We are living in a world of you have postmodernism, and now I do believe we are in a post-truth society where everything has become relative, and you know all the modern philosophers and ancient philosophers warned about this, you know, when they were philosophizing, and because what you have is you have like when basically a truth erupts from whatever idea or feeling or emotion any individual has, then you have to respect that truth. But yet my truth may not be, you know, what it is it's a rejection of absolutism just in general. That's the legacy that the postmodernists left, was a rejection of absolutism. But yet to reject absolutism is being absolutist because it's like, you know, I mean, it's like an ontological error in even trying to maintain a relative mindset. For me to say my truth is just as relevant as yours, and we can't really it's just as relevant as your truth, and we can't really say what is true. But you just said what is true. You know, you saying that your truth is your truth and it's relevant and it should be respected and equal to other truth is a truth statement. And I agree with you because, you know, not in terms of just general absolutism, but it's hard to make a truth statement these days. You know, the logicians must be going crazy because you know, I see this. I see exactly what you're talking about. And religions are being challenged by this. But I think religion should be challenged in any way possible. But yeah, they're being challenged by this too, by this relativistic, you know, I also agree with Jeffrey. I do believe that it's possible to have, because see, the truth, you don't think that when you talk about the truth and absolutism, that it's limiting, but it's not. It's just saying, like Gebster said, that, you know, that there's something universal and everlasting about the truth where it never loses relevance, okay? Yeah, there's something about it, Jeffrey, about the truth. It never loses relevance. It's universal, and it's possible, if it's real truth, for it to permeate through other worldviews and other ideas and ways of thinking and still maintain its truth status. So in that sense, I understand relativism in the sense that truth can't be limited, but it's at the same time, I still think that it's that there's an absolute, you know, you can't escape truth. You can't, you know, and that's what the postmodernists, I think, were trying to do. And now they succeeded in that. And now we have, like you said, this post-truth culture where it, you know, when a post-truth, so the way I see relativism, it's like a 4 billion headed dragon in the, you know, like the cosmos. It's like this 4 billion headed dragon. And every time someone else claims the truth, another head grows. And then you have this cosmological image of, whoa, Okay, so where do I fall into it? And that's where I the relativism is kind of, I don't know. I don't think that's the direction we're going, but I agree with you. I've never read Wilbur, but I'm going to read him now.
No. So I want to just, I think when we talk about a post-truth world, there's at least two ways of taking mm-hmm. that. One is saying that there really is, like that the world is correct, that that's what reality is. Reality is not, is post-truth. The other interpretation is that's what our culture, society, historical moment, that's how it's constructing its relationship to reality. But right. that from a philosophical or a spiritual point of view, we could see through that, or we could make better sense than what, you know, is the case, what appears to be the case currently. Just a word on Wilbur. So Wilbur is an integral philosopher, or he's associated, okay. call himself an integral philosopher. I have studied with him in the past. I'm not associated with him anymore. But he drew on the work of Gebser, Aurobindo, Desjardins, various others, and sort of created his own summary of their philosophies, and he calls it integral. You know, he has his own like trademarked framework, you know, called all quadrants, all levels, all lines. Anyway, you could learn about him. But he did write this book called The Religion of Tomorrow, and A Vision for the Future of the Great Traditions. In his view, religions are a positive aspect of human evolution, and that there are expressions of them that are ethnocentric or exclusionary, but there are also potential expressions of them that are more universal and more spiritual. And he has this metaphor. I don't particularly like the metaphor that much, but he calls it a conveyor belt. And the idea is that religions can help people grow up, develop more spiritual maturity through introducing them at a young age or in young levels of psychological development to more rules and roles to play. But then as they grow, expanding perspectives and including more philosophical and then more spiritual ways of relating to reality. So that's his view. He's another author. And I think that, I mean, it's relevant because what I'm curious, the paradox of spirituality in a social setting is that it's hard to have society without order.
Yeah.
And so how do you have an orderly society without reifying it into these pre-packaged ideological constructs, which are what religions usually offer? That's like the question, that's like my research question is, how would you keep, because here's one, I think one of the other differences between spirituality and religion is that spirituality deals with living truth, and religion codifies that truth into dogmas, rules, prohibitions, etc.
Yeah.
But the spiritual perspective is beyond the mental. So it's beyond the codification. Yeah. It's a living relationship with what is alive and real and true right now.
Yeah.
And so how do you have that and order at the same time? Like what kind of order do you have to have that doesn't kill the spirit?
I'll tell you.
Tell me.
No, I was going to say, the kind of order that you have, and this is the goal of religion, well, I know the goal of Christianity, is to internalize the law, okay? So the goal, and I know it sounds, you know, of the utopian goal of a religion or Christianity, or I'd say this is maybe a pattern that's characteristic universally about religions, is that their goal in terms of establishing order is not for the order to come externally, but for it to be internalized. That's why Christianity always talks about the kingdom of God being inside of you and all of this stuff. Because the idea was that, you know, you approach religion and through your spiritual maturity, you have achieved spiritual maturity when the law is internalized and you have an intrinsic motive to act in a way that promotes order, not because you are afraid of it from some outside consequence, but you've internalized the consequence. You know, maybe your own conscience becomes the, you know, becomes sort of like the barrier between right action and wrong action. And so, yeah, it's like an internalized righteousness in a sense. That's what religion. That was the goal of religion, and it had to be achieved through spirituality. So I think that that's the way that you would establish order is, you know, is you gotta get people to internalize that. And that, like you said, and that's one of the characteristics of spirituality. It's internal. And in a way, religion being more external, it's like they're using external resources to try to get people to internalize, you know, the law or their doctrine. And that's, you know, I don't know how that's going to work, but I know that that's the goal of most religions. I mean, does that make sense? Like, because when you ask about order, how do you establish order in a society? Well, we know that there are many ways you can establish order, brute force, you know, democracy, education, all that kind of stuff that we try today all the time. But, you know, in terms of, but when you can get someone to internalize it, to internalize their morality, so, you know, so that they want to do, they desire to do the right thing, apart from any kind of gain or loss, that's when you can achieve order, I think. I don't know. I think that's the goal. That's ultimately how they wanted to achieve order. That is, and I'm getting a little bit esoteric here. I apologize, but that is what the goal of when Christians refer to the kingdom of heaven and what have you and Christ ruling. Well, the idea behind that is that Christ really doesn't have to rule. He'll be present because people will have the law, you know, they'll have an intrinsic motivation to do the right thing. Righteousness will be like internal. So there really is no need for rule or for law or for, you know, or for discipline, because, you know, it's like a self-discipline. And you know that Eastern religions promote that too. That's why they're all into, you know, destroying the certain desires and what have you, that like that motivate you to make wrong choices or whatever. So I mean, I think that that's the only way, is people have to internalize it. And some people have, you know, and maybe the communities that are the most, maybe the religious, I want to say the spiritual communities that are the most successful in maintaining order, maybe it's because that they have got this, that they indoctrinate or they practice their faith or spirit in a way that educates and supports self-governing, yeah, you all mentioned self-governing principles within the within their parishioners or whatever. They develop, or their congregation, they develop self-governing principles, which people internalize them in these spiritual communities. And yeah, you're going to have an incredible amount of order, because people want to do the right thing. They want to not be, you know, so I think that that's one way is of establishing order, is trying to get people to develop principles, spiritual principles of self-governance. And you, like I said, you all have a thread about that on IC about self-governance. I think self-governance is the key to order in the society.
I think that's a great point. Spiritual principles of self-governance. I picked that up at some point again.
I have to get going. I've got other meetings.
Yeah, I hope this is thank useful you. To your 20-year plan, Jeffrey.
Yeah, it is. I've been working on it. That's what I love about IC, is that you all put the resources there, even if someone's not present or available to do the Zoom cast. So I'm going to go back and read. I was really interested in the long now. I was reading about that. So, yeah, this has been really helpful. Thank you. And I really respect what you're trying to do, Mr. G. I think that would be, if that's one of your visions, wow. If you can get science and spirituality to develop, like, you know, a loving relationship, and that would be, man, that would set us off in a whole new direction in terms of, you know, the evolution of human consciousness and what we can achieve. I think that's a wonderful, wonderful goal. So I support that. treatments.
All right. Sorry, Jeffrey. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I'll need lots of help.
Yeah, I can imagine. That's funny. Well, you've got
Jeffrey, one of the things that stood out to me was of your list of things, your second year plan, or second 20-year plan, but it was also in your first 20-year plan, is find like-minded individuals. And that's really difficult for a person like myself. That's a very hard thing to do.
It's a case of talking with as many people as you can and then jumping on opportunities as they present themselves.
Getting too angry.
Yeah. Well, there is that too.
Jump on opportunities when you see an opportunity to unify, you know. Yeah. That's what I love to listen for, is that I'm not listening for points to disagree with. I'm listening for points to agree. Yeah, I get, you know, so finding cohesion and instead of looking for an argument or a dispute, you know, I focus on things that we have in common. And then that's what I zone in on, you know, with like-minded people. So, yeah. Well, thank you. You have my support, Jeffrey. I think it's great. But thank you. I'm going to go because I have while going to work now. So, but thank you so much. This has been great. And I can't wait to meet with you guys tomorrow if you're going to be there.
Definitely. That's at 12 p.m. Eastern time, correct?
Right, Jeffrey? Exactly.
Okay. Yes, that's
the
right.
The time was wrong on the post.
Oh, okay.
But Doug
corrected. No, it was wrong.
You it was right?
Thank okay. you.
It was wrong for me. Yeah. But Doug corrected it. It should be 12
p.m. Okay.
tomorrow.
Okay.
All right. Well, you all enjoy the rest of your day.
You too, Katina.
Yep. See you tomorrow.
Bye bye.
Bye bye. Nice meeting you all. Bye bye.